both children and a job. You're keenly aware of this already. The school day and the work day pretty much never match up. School's over in the middle of the afternoon. Most offices expect you working until the early evening, not to mention the unorthodox work hours of a lot of jobs in retail or healthcare or the service industry. So why is it so hard to find after-school childcare? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The lack of good, affordable options is obviously a problem for families, and it may have broader effects on the economy, productivity, even public safety. But just a single U.S. state has made after-school care for public school students a major priority. Elsewhere, for every one child enrolled in after-school programs, there are an estimated four others who need such care but don't receive it. Rachel Cohen covers domestic social policy for Vox, where you can read her recent article, America's After-School Afterthought. Rachel, welcome back to Think.
Hi, thank you so much for having me again.
I thought it was interesting that the family you profile at the start of this piece is headed by a doctor and her husband in Durham, North Carolina. So presumably these are folks with the resources to pay somebody to look after their twins after school. But they were devastated when their sons were moved from these confirmed slots in their school's aftercare program to the waiting list. There just aren't a lot of other options out there.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's a really important thing to highlight. You know, this is an issue that affects, you know, cost is a huge barrier to after-school care. So low-income families do have, you know, real serious challenges paying for after-school care if it's available. But really, this is a crisis that all working families are facing, even professionals and white-collar workers. If you have two parents or one parent, any if you're of a household where both parents are, you know, are working, it doesn't matter how much you make, because oftentimes what, you know, even higher income parents face is there aren't really people you can just hire to take care of your kids, even if you wanted to, because there are fewer people working in these jobs all across the country, especially since the pandemic.
And it wasn't just this one family in Durham. More than 700 kids who needed care between the end of school and the time their parents were done with work were kicked off the list in Durham.
That's right. And, you know, Durham is actually unique because in a lot of communities, a lot of public school districts don't even offer any after school care at all. So this is a community where the school district does try to provide a pretty subsidized rate of after school care, but, you know, they really couldn't meet the demand. And you can easily go to plenty of other areas and there's not even anything at all through the school district.
So adults of a certain age listening to this conversation may have grown up as latchkey kids and lived to tell the tale. But first of all, we really just don't do that anymore. And these days, even if some parents are comfortable with older kids being home alone, if they don't qualify for bus service, if they don't live close enough to walk to and from school, it's just not an option.
That's right. And, you know, I think, yes, it's a little bit, you know, there are definitely some parents who are a little more okay with their older children staying home. But, you know, there are so many children under the age of 12, under the age of 10, who just, you know, families rightly don't feel comfortable letting their kids just be by themselves or get home at the end of the day. And there are a lot of safety issues that parents are thinking about. So it's not just about providing enriching opportunities, although that is part of it. It's an extension of the childcare issue that we don't typically think about.
So the Durham School District did this thing that a lot of places have recommended, that they made school start much later for high schoolers because teenagers are on kind of a different sleep schedule, and they made school start earlier for elementary school students. Everybody had good intentions, but this really messed up the aftercare problem for working parents, didn't it?
Yeah, I thought it was a very interesting example of the kind of thing that can happen when you have a very, you know, a policy-based research backed idea. There is good science that, you know, older students, you know, do need more sleep. It could help them. There was sort of energy efficiency reasons. The bus routes they thought could help make them operate on a more efficient route. But people then weren't thinking, oh, well, if we move elementary schools earlier, then we're going to have this situation where hundreds more kids under the age of 10 are going to be getting out of school much earlier in the afternoon than they were before. And the thing is, a lot of places just don't see that as their problem. It's something parents should figure out, even if before they could pick up their kids at 4:30 or 5, now they have to figure out how to get them at 2:15. So these are the kinds of challenges, and it is a good example, I think, of how tweaking something somewhere in a system can have all these downstream effects that maybe people didn't think about. Or I think some parents would say, hey, we did tell you about it. We did warn you this, and you didn't prioritize it. You didn't think this was something that, we really need to start preparing for months in advance, given the change you wanted to make.
I've heard people make the argument that schools were never intended to be a childcare service, but that's how they function. The fact that kids are in school all day allows millions of American parents to work.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true. I feel like I run into this a lot in my reporting. We like some childcare workers, there's a sense, oh, maybe they'll be more respected if you call them early childhood education workers, and there's sort of debates over, like, sometimes childcare workers, they say, well, we're not babysitters, we do more than that. And everyone's kind of denigrating everyone else in the process, as if care work is, lesser than education work. And I think we can acknowledge that public schools serve a really important academic function. They also serve a really important childcare function for families. One challenge, and I do think this is shifting, but it certainly has been a sentiment in some communities for a long time, is this question of, like, yeah, whose job is it to take care of kids? Is it the state? Is it the family? Is it the grandparents? Whatever. Should the mom be working at all, or should she be home with the kids? And so we have this whole system that was really created at a time before there were as many mothers working outside the home. And I think we're just still sort of grappling with the relic of a system that hasn't quite changed, although people kind of recognize it's not working.
What kind of shortage did you find nationwide in these services?
So, kind of the best survey that was done to date came out right before the pandemic in 2020. And at that time, they found, there's about 8 million, there were about 8 million children enrolled in an after-school program, but that was really less than a fourth of the total demand that parents were saying they would want if there was something, affordable and accessible to them in their community. So we're talking nearly 25 million more children would be enrolled in an after-school program if they could be, if there was one for them to go to. So that's kind of the figure used nationally when people are trying to figure out demand and unmet demand. And that's a lot of kids. That's nearly 25 million more children would be in after school if they could be.
What happens to families whose kids need this care but cannot secure it? How do they cope? What are their options?
So, I mean, it's a great question. So the landscape looks different all over the country. Even, within a state or a county, could look really different. Sometimes there are church programs. Sometimes you might have one or two nonprofits, like a Girls and Boys Club of America or the YMCA. But those places also have wait lists and limited capacity and are dealing with their own staffing challenges. So, it ends up being a mix. Oftentimes, one parent has to reduce their hours or quit their job. Some people rely on family or neighbors or friends. There's a real lack of good options in this area. And it's, I talked to honestly so many parents, mostly mothers, who said, yeah, I had to stop working, or I had to, like, switch my job for a couple of years because there wasn't any good option for me. And the thing that they said to me often was they weren't expecting it. Like, we have this pretty vocal discussion about the high cost of daycares and preschools and things like that, and we sort of know that's a big challenge. But there is this feeling, oh, once my kids get into traditional public school, once they're in that setting, I'll be okay, and we can sort of figure it out. And then the lack of after school options takes a lot of families by surprise, because it's not something we talk much about.
I remember when my own children graduated from daycare to public school, and I thought it'll be just like I got a raise. We were able to find after school care on their campus, but there's another expense. And in 2023, these services are not inexpensive.
That's right. That is right. The sort of average cost right now is about $100 per week per kid. There are some subsidized nonprofits in certain high poverty areas, but cost is reportedly the biggest barrier. And most parents are paying out of pocket. This is not something right now that the state or the federal government or local communities really offer much financial assistance to. So it's really just this extra childcare cost that a lot of families have to balancing, okay, is this expense versus working in my job these hours? Can I be like, what is the trade-off? And it's a really grueling math problem for a lot of families.
How did the COVID shutdowns set us up for an even more serious shortage than we had before?
So we did have a shortage before COVID, but it has gotten worse for a couple of reasons. One, as you know, we have had a pretty competitive hiring market, tight economy over the last year and a half. So a lot of employers have been raising their wages, have been increasing the benefit offerings they're giving. Just really large chain employers like Target and Starbucks and Walmart and CVS. And so the thing about after school care, it's always been a fairly challenging job to hire for in the sense that, it doesn't really happen in the summer. It's an average of 4 hours a day. They're part-time jobs without benefits, which can be good for some people, but a lot of people would prefer to have more hours and would prefer to have more benefits if they could. And suddenly there's a lot of employers wanting to give those things. So there's been a huge sort of exodus of people going to these higher paying jobs that can offer more benefits. And there were a number of a lot of people who worked in after school care, were older or had, were volunteers, and then they had health care concerns about being in schools in congregate settings and didn't want to catch COVID. So a lot of people kind of left during the pandemic for those reasons. And so it's not unique to after school. Like these are caretaking jobs and education jobs and some healthcare worker jobs. Everyone's dealing with this hiring challenge, but after school is a particularly, I think, difficult sector because they are generally part-time jobs and they can't offer the kind of benefits that even like a school paraprofessional or a healthcare worker can do. So it's just become very competitive nationwide.
And now, if we want to call this time post-COVID, many companies are less flexible than they were for a couple of years.
Yes. And this is adding to the challenge parents are having because, the last couple of years, maybe your employer was a little more flexible about working from home. And now they're sort of, maybe they're not making you come back 5 days a week, but if you don't have aftercare, you're still in a bind for those other days where you're no longer allowed to be at home with your kid.
Rachel, clearly there is a benefit to after-school care in terms of parents' ability to work full-time. What do we know about the benefits to children who participate in these programs versus, say, going home and fending for themselves for several hours?
We know, A, that there are high quality after school programs and there are lower quality after school programs. So not all after school programs are the same, not all are good, but they've been around long enough that we do know what goes into a good one. And there's been a lot of research done. The federal government has commissioned studies to sort of figure out what makes something high quality and enriching and stimulating. So that's one piece of it. So in researching high quality after school programs, research shows that it helps with all sorts of things. It provides academic support. Kids can get tutoring and mentoring opportunities. You can get a lot of sort of physical education and nutritional background. There's a lot of Some after-school programs do cooking classes or learn about, you know, food and health. There's also a lot of benefits just socially and so socio-emotionally, which is a huge concern right now among parents and schools coming out of the pandemic, because we do have a huge mental health crisis among students and teenagers right now. And after-school programs provide really kind of structured ways to build positive relationships with other students and mentors and adults. So those are some of the big, I'd say, student benefits. Another one is definitely sort of safety and helps reduce crime. The biggest hours of the day in which youth crime happens is between 2 and 6 p.m. And so there's been studies about like what happens if kids have can be in after school instead, and they sort of have a little more structured time, supervised time, and there have been sort of benefits shown in that way. So I think I would say the one of the clearest ways it was explained to me, and I saw this as I traveled to watch programs, is it's not just extended class time. It's not just, you know, more sitting in a classroom like you do during the regular day. And it's not just unstructured playtime, you know, if it's a good program. It's really something different. It's really something where kids can get the kinds of opportunities and sort of enrichment, club, theater, dance, sports kind of activities that they can't get during school and in their regular lives.
It also seems like a great opportunity to deliver those experiences to lower income students that maybe the rich kids have that otherwise put them at an advantage.
Yes, absolutely. You know, sports today are almost entirely pay to play around the country. And you know, I got to visit a really cool program in Oakland, California, that was funded with these after-school dollars to provide free elementary school sports leagues to students. And it's just those aren't really available in a lot of communities today unless you can afford to pay for them and also afford to pay for the cleats and the travel to the games and the tournament fees and all these extra things, even beyond just joining the league fees.
I mean, ordinarily, when there is a huge unmet demand for some service, we can just count on the private sector flooding in to meet that demand. But I guess it's hard enough to break even providing this service that making a profit is almost out of the question, given what most families can afford.
Yeah, it is a really challenging issue for that reason. Like, you know, already even there's only so much you can charge families before they say, okay, I can't justify this expense in my budget anymore. And for low-income families, they can't even reach the fee. And so it's a really just economically, without giving some sort of public subsidy, you're going to either price out families. And this was something that Durham had said, you know, when I was speaking with the school district, they said, like, look, we know there's this wait list, but also we're trying to keep costs down. We can't keep, if we raise prices, then maybe we'll be able to attract some more workers, but we're definitely going to then lose, we're not going to be able to serve the families we need to. And so there's this big tension between, being able to pay the workers more and filling that need and not pricing out families. And that's, I think, why it's really difficult to figure out what would a sustainable policy solution be without some public subsidy.
In some places, teachers' unions actually object to really robust funding for after-school care. What is that about?
Yeah, so this was something I saw, you know, you see it a little bit more on the local level than in sort of national, the big teacher unions have, you know, are in coalition with after school groups. I think it's for a couple of reasons. One, you know, after school programs tend to be these nonprofit organizations. They're not unionized. Teacher unions generally want more money to go to teachers and the traditional school day, and so after school sort of separate. I think it's just in this sort of general fight for resources, funding for after school seems like is kind of a different pot, and their members are not in it. And it's challenging because there isn't a union or really a lobby for after school. And so in a lot of these fights over dollars. It can, you know, if a teacher union, I don't want listeners to think they're the main reason we haven't funded this, because that's not true. It's just an additional political barrier that can come up when this is being considered, but it's not the main barrier, I would say, but it's part of this larger fight over, you know, limited resources and fighting over those limited resources.
If there is such enormous unmet demand and after-school care has so many demonstrable benefits, why do you think communities haven't made this a priority across the country?
So I think what I found, and the reason my story was called After School Afterthought, America's After School Afterthought, is because, you know, it's just not, no one quite sees it as their responsibility. Like, we haven't agreed, unlike traditional public school, where we say, okay, we know the state is responsible for educating, you know, kids between the ages of like 5 and 17 in these hours of the day. These other hours of the day, it's no one's like sort of legal responsibility in the same way. And so no one's quite stepped up, and everyone sort of agrees it should be done, but the onus on and whose job it is and who needs to fund it has not been really clear. Now, I think there is a lot of opportunity for sort of organizing and pressing on leaders and state governments to step up on that. I think the challenge, the reason we haven't seen that as much, is just because it's a diffuse group. Parents have a lot of stuff they're working on. They're juggling. When you're in the thick of balancing childcare and working, it's hard to also be an organized political force. And so there's just, I really do think it could change. I don't think this is an intractable public policy problem. I think it's just been one where the real reason we haven't seen as much change as I think we could is it just hasn't risen to the top of anyone's agenda. There's always something else more pressing or urgent that people are focused on. And so it's difficult, even though it's causing a lot of chaos for millions of families.
You mentioned the strong after-school program set up in Oakland, California, a few minutes ago, and California is actually kind of a watershed state when it comes to looking at this issue, isn't it?
Yes, it is. California is definitely a national leader, and they have been for several decades. And I think the understanding California's story is really instructive and rather hopeful for other places, because it really started with some educators and activists and parents organizing together in their individual cities in LA and San Diego and San Francisco and Sacramento. And then coming together and saying, we think the state should put forward some money for this. We think this should be a state responsibility. So they started pressing state lawmakers in the mid-1990s, and they won only a small, really, budget allocation in 1997, but they kept going, and then that budget allocation increased in 2002. And then Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was preparing to run for governor, took up the issue. He saw it as a really sort of good way for parent to sort of help parents and help kids. And he actually helped fund a ballot initiative in 2002 in California to increase public dollars for after school, and it passed. And that led to state constitutionally protected dollars for after school. But you know, the organizing continued. And so even beyond that, in 2021, California lawmakers increased funding even more, and now they dedicate something like $6 billion per year for after-school summer learning and before-school learning. And it's really, really incredible.
And again, the learning isn't precisely the same. They're not sitting down, these kids are not sitting down and drilling what they learned in a third grade classroom all day. These are kind of different activities, right?
Right. So, you know, they can be all sorts of things, but I mean, there can be, and there is, you know, tutoring opportunities. If you need extra help with something you've been learning in class, so that is a definite thing you can find in a lot of after school. But there's so many other things. There's robotics, there's coding, there's soccer, there's theater, there's you know, sports and gym class and playing games and really running the gamut of kind of different recreational and educational activities that are separate from the traditional school day. They use the term in California, expanded learning. That's kind of what the umbrella they put it under.
You mentioned that really solid after school programs are associated with lower levels of youth crime. I'm assuming that crime is not being committed by elementary school students. Do the California programs also create opportunities for, say, middle and high schoolers to do things after school?
Yes. So that is one of the actually unique things. So California, because it allocates, you know, unique levels of state funding, they're actually one of the only states right now in the entire country that uses their federal after-school dollars, which I should clarify, the federal government does not give that much money to after-school, but it has one basically funding stream that it dedicates every year. And California uses that money to help fund spots for high schoolers. And so their goal, their ultimate goal, they would like to make it universally available for any after-schooler who wants it. They're not there yet, but that is their goal. And they currently offer more spots for after-schoolers than really any other state.
Rachel, describe for us what a really quality after-school program feels like. I mean, you've mentioned the activities. When you observe one of these programs and the kids are really engaged, what is that like?
You know, it's hard to answer without sounding like very earnest, but it, honestly, it's so nice to see. It really just fills you with such warmth and sort of respect. You know, the educators and the staff, they're so upbeat and engaged and kind of meeting these boisterous kids with lots of energy, and they're meeting them where they are. I felt tired just watching it, honestly. But I think, you know, I think that they're places really for, you know, in the school day, kids have to sit quiet. They have to, you know, they're really focused on learning all the content that they have to through the day. After school, I think is really neat because it's both trying to help students grow and develop positive relationships, but in a way that I think is meeting them with the energy that they have and kind of the excitement they have for different things. So I really feel like there's a lot of really good social bonding that happens in these places. And I think it really helps, especially with the really big crisis of loneliness a lot of kids have, especially with the isolation from social media and their phones all day. So I think it's a really good kind of reprieve from some of those daily pressures.
What kind of training do the workers need to do this work well?
You know, that's a good question. I think it's definitely not, they don't just hire anyone. And some states have certain requirements like, you know, CPR training and different, and some school districts have requirements around that. But it's definitely lower barrier to entry than, say, being a teacher or some other education workers, which I think is a good thing. And one of the things that I, you know, encountered as I was learning about the staffing crisis is like some people think, oh, well, if we have a staffing crisis, maybe we should raise the pay and like make it look like a more prestigious job and then raise the credentials. And a lot of the advocates working in this field think that's a really terrible idea because it shouldn't be, you don't want to make it so that it's harder to work in after school. You just want to make it, you want to open up pathways that after school workers can then use their experience to rise up elsewhere if they want other kinds of jobs. Right now, after school workers tend to be more diverse and reflective of the students they serve than K-12 teachers. A lot of them are more likely to live in the same communities and speak the student's first language. So I think it's a pretty low barrier. Like a lot of college students work it, or maybe you're retired. Seniors and communities volunteer. They don't take just anyone, but I think if listeners are sort of interested in getting involved in this space, I think there's a lot. You definitely don't have to get a degree or anything like that.
It's funny that there's a lack of prestige because anyone who's dealt with kids knows it can be a real challenge to bring energy and enthusiasm to that work every single day.
I completely agree. I live in Washington, D.C., and there's been this very controversial push to add new requirements for college degrees for early childhood workers. And I just think it's so silly. It's not like they teach any of that in college. You know, you don't like it's just it's a different kind of skill set. And I have great respect for workers who can do that. And I think, you know, what we do in a college classroom is not preparation for that kind of work.
Rachel, what has California learned about recruiting and retaining good workers to look after their kids after school?
Well, so to be clear, it is definitely still something California is working on, and not every community is doing it as well as others. But what is clear in California, where the minimum wage is now $15.50 an hour, in this post-pandemic time with a tight competitive labor market, they recognize that unless if they're not, you know, offering $20 an hour or so, it's going to be really hard to get applicants because there's just so many other options. So definitely school programs that are offering competitive wages, you know, 20, 22, 24, $26 an hour, those are more likely to get good applicants, and they're more likely to keep them because retention is a huge problem. And some other programs have been experimenting with other kinds of recruitment and retention ideas, like, for example, some school districts are trying to see how they can combine some of the COVID education dollars to help, you know, if you can give after school workers some more hours by saying, hey, maybe if you can come into school at noon and you can provide some tutoring and mentoring, then we could pay you for an extra, you know, 3 hours that day. And then if they can come in even earlier, sometimes school districts are finding maybe they can actually make them full-time workers and then eligible for benefits. So I think there's a lot of thinking happening right now about like how do we have a workforce where like some people really only want the part-time job and that's perfect for them and it works really well, especially with college students and some retirees, but others would do the work if they could also combine it with some other kind of education work that might even allow them to get benefits too.
I think a lot of people think of California as just this deep blue state, but in a manner similar to Texas, right, there are pockets of deep red within that deep blue. In Texas, there are pockets of blue within the red. Was it controversial as California was building up this program? Were there people who objected to spending public money for a project like this?
It's a good question. And I know what you mean. Sometimes as a journalist covering policy, sometimes I'm like, oh, but California is so unique. I think it's really notable that it was Arnold Schwarzenegger who really led the push. He's been the biggest vocal advocate, and he's a Republican leader. So I think that helped. And, you know, he kept framing it in the terms of, you know, working parents and working families. Now, you might have, there are sort of pockets of more, you know, religious cultural conservative objections, but I think just general conservative, like fiscally conservative, there are ways this can be very framed to appeal to conservatives, which is also why, you know, I wrote about in Vermont, Republican Governor Phil Scott. He's also made after school a kind of key issue for him, and you see other conservatives leaning into the public safety crime prevention angle. You see also some, there's been really interesting research about how good after school programs, in addition to crime, can also help deter young people from substance abuse and drug use and alcohol use. And so there are sort of different arguments you can make, I think, for different audiences that really do cross partisan lines. I think a lot of these things about safety and the economy and making it easier for families to work and learning loss and, you know, academic recovery. There's sort of a lot of different ways into the after school issue. And I think the only reason we really haven't heard them as much is because of what we were talking earlier, which is just there's been all these other issues that have gotten a lot more attention and prioritization.
I don't know whether in the course of your reporting you looked at other countries, but are there places in the world that do this particularly well?
The research that I was talking about just now about substance abuse, that was actually some research done in Finland. I think this is more of an issue. America has more gaps in its just general childcare infrastructure. It's everything's more individualized. Everything falls more on, parents to figure out. But there are definitely other countries, and I think Finland is one that has garnered a lot of notice, especially for some of the other benefits that researchers found, like particularly like health and safety.
We're starting to see some demographers in the United States raise alarm bells about the numbers of Americans who are interested in having children, and we are having children below the replacement rate. Is anybody mm-hmm. talking about things like after-school care as one way to ease the burden that parents feel when they or prospective parents feel when they consider the prospect of having children?
You know, not as much as I think they should, but because I think they, you're hearing it a lot about childcare. You're hearing that argument made a lot with childcare. And I think that is important to be talking about. I think after school is this subset of the childcare conversation that we don't talk about. And that's why so many families end up being surprised when they get to, you know, first grade or so on, and then say, oh my God, you didn't, I didn't realize it was going to be this bad. This is so crazy. I think there's actually a lot of political, I think a Republican or a Democrat, has a lot of reason to talk about it. Now, I in my story, I talk about Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan. She has been leaning into the idea of after school in the last 2 years. Mayor Muriel Bowser of Washington, D.C., where I live, has been talking about it a lot. Phil Scott in Vermont. So Arnold Schwarzenegger made it a very successful political issue, and it's kind of been surprising to me that so few people have really followed in his footsteps. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see if more people do lift that up as just another way could possibly make it easier for a family on the fence to have children.
You mentioned that California has also invested resources in summer care. This is a whole other issue for parents. I mean, even if you've mm-hmm. made the school year work, there's that scramble starting in February or March to line up summer camps or programs. First of all, it's expensive, and it just takes a huge amount of time and emotional labor to find places for kids to go all summer.
Yeah, I felt so, I see it just in parents I know around me, but doing the story, it's also just like, no one's really helping. Everyone's kind of competing with one another.
Right.
It really has so many of the same issues as after school, where it's like, no one really sees it as their responsibility other than falling on the backs of parents to just figure it out.
So is the California program scalable? Could it be translated to other states? California's spending $5 billion a year. That's a lot of money. How much is this within the reach of states that maybe have smaller populations and smaller budgets?
You know, I think it is. I think it is scalable. And I think, you know, they made the point to me, which I felt like was well taken, which was they didn't get to $5 billion overnight. The first time they got a state allocation, it was $50 million. And then it went up to something like $122 million. And so you can kind of start small and go from there. I think the other piece of it is there are a lot of things we're currently funding that could go towards after school in the same vein. So for example, public safety budgets. It's not defunding the police. It's not talking about that, but it's talking about, if we are allocating money for crime prevention and community safety, well, maybe some of that budget should go towards after school, given what we know it can help, teens that might be at risk for that kind of thing. Similarly, there's a lot of state governments have budgets for, healthcare and mental health, and they're trying to figure out what do we do about this youth mental health crisis. Well, maybe some of that money could go towards building programs for students who are, feeling isolated and need more social connection. So I think I was disappointed yesterday. The White House released its budget, and President Biden, though he proposed increases for childcare, he did not propose any increase to the federal after-school budget line, which was something that after-school advocates said they were very disappointed about. So I think we should see more of that. I think there's also opportunity for other things that states and communities are currently funding that could, fall on, could maybe, should maybe go towards after school and achieve some of their existing goals better.
Rachel, do most advocates of these programs think that they are best administered on school campuses, or do they work better when you put students on a bus and take them across town to a program somewhere?
I think that it varies. I think it can be more convenient if it's happening at school. Often, what happens in a lot of places is that ideally it would be at school in a school building, and then oftentimes like a nonprofit will come to the school and, run the program there. That's a common way to do it. But I think, just there are good programs that exist in YMCAs and churches and other community locations. I think a lot of it is just about how accessible it is for a family to get the kid get and pick them up. Transportation to and from is a barrier for people, so it's definitely one of those things where if it works for your family, that's great, but it can be an impediment for people, especially like, you might not have time to drive your kid to across town to a nonprofit in the afternoon if you have to work. It might not actually solve your workday issues. But I think people also feel like there aren't even enough options of those, even if they wanted them.
Do kids enjoy going to these programs? I mean, did you get the sense that they are begging their parents to pick them up early, or that they're not wanting to leave when mom and dad show up?
Oh, I definitely don't think they're, I definitely didn't get the sense they're begging to leave early. I think I really, it was really just really nice to see. The kids seemed really, really happy and excited, and they all have friends there. They go every day, a lot of them. And so it seems like a time where they just got to have some positive experiences.
I wonder if one impediment to parents or adults in general being enthusiastic about supporting these programs is that maybe they grew up without this kind of care and just feel like what was good enough for them should be good enough for today's children. But we don't, there are a million things we do differently with each generation of parents that we don't seem to question.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think and there are, class-based differences in that too. I think it can be difficult to here, like this would be, you should do this, it would help your kid if you, and parents rightly probably think, eh, it's probably fine, or like I don't want to spend the money, or I didn't have that. But I think what we do know is that millions of parents do want that, and there just isn't affordable and accessible options for those families who do.
And I guess we also can't leave it to parents who need these services to set them up. I mean, working parents are already pretty strapped for time. This seems like it really needs champions within communities and governments.
Exactly. I agree. I think it's really a space where there needs to be leadership, and it feels unfair and unrealistic to expect that leadership to come from the parents who are in need of care themselves. I mean, and that's not to say there aren't parents organizing and trying, but I think this is why we have elected officials and school boards and things like that. Like there needs to be kind of a recognition of the problem, which hopefully, the show and my reporting and other things help bring light to. And there just needs to really be someone who says, all right, this can't go on. We need to figure this out. We can figure this out. Let's take a look at the budget. Let's get this together.
Rachel Cohen covers domestic social policy for Vox, where you can read her recent article, America's After School Afterthought. Rachel, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks very much for making time today.
Oh, thank you so much.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think and then subscribe. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.